Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks to everyone who supports Daily Tech News Show directly. To find out more, head to dailytechnewsshow.com/support.
This is the Daily Tech News Show for Friday, September 28th in Los Angeles. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane from Studio Feline.
And from the fringes of LA County, I'm Roger Chang.
And of course, this is our roundtable show. Once a month, we expand our show into a full-fledged one-hour roundtable discussion with Sarah, myself, and our guests. Joining us today, Patrick Norton from TechThing.com and AVXL. Welcome back, Patrick.
Thank you.
And Ryan Shrout from PCPer.com. It's been a little while longer since we've had you on, Ryan. Good to have you back, too.
It is. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And as every Friday, we have Len Peralta illustrating the show. Len, are your drawing fingers ready?
My drawing fingers are always ready.
They sure are. That's what I always say about you. Constantly. People are like, just stop.
All the time.
Talking about Len's fingers. It's weird. It's creepy. Okay. Well, all of our topics today cover the tech news. We're going to start with a few tech things you should know.
Facebook says it discovered an attack earlier this week that affected up to 50 million users. Attackers were able to exploit the View As feature to copy access tokens. So, View As lets you see what your page looks like to someone else on Facebook who might be checking it out. A bug was loading the video uploader during the View As session, which incorrectly created a single sign-on token using the identity of the person you were viewing as, not actually you. Attackers did this intentionally and then copied those tokens. Facebook says it has patched the vulnerability and logged out more than 90 million accounts invalidating previously issued tokens. Because only the tokens were accessed, the company says users don't need to change passwords. Law enforcement is investigating. You should probably still change your password.
I mean, it's never a bad idea, but I get what they're saying, which is they didn't access the password at all. They accessed the token that's set after the password. So, yeah. CNBC reports the U.S. SEC and Tesla CEO Elon Musk had agreed to a settlement over fraud allegations where Musk and Tesla would pay fines. Musk would step down as chairman of Tesla for 2 years, and two new independent directors would be appointed to Tesla's board. That was going to avoid the lawsuit from yesterday, but... Instead of taking that and not having to admit guilt, Musk refused to sign the deal. CNBC said he didn't feel it would be truthful to himself. He has called the allegations unjustified, and the Tesla board issued a statement expressing full confidence in Musk. Of course, Musk is a large part of that board, so the saga continues.
Spiegel Online and Quartz report that Spotify has begun emailing some users of its premium for family plans in Germany, the U.S., and two other markets asking for GPS data to confirm that they all live at the same address. Ah, yes, the family plan. The email contains a link to a page that states Spotify will only use the GPS data to verify location, not for anything else. Spotify responded to Quartz saying it's testing improvements to the user experience of premium for Spotify. Spotify's average revenue per user fell 12% in Q2. Might be something to think about. TechCrunch reports that Spotify has since ended the test.
Real quickly, Google began rolling out Wear OS 2.1 to watches Friday. The new interface focuses on fitness and notifications, also improves some of the responsiveness and battery life.
Apple won an appeal against a decision that it had infringed patents held by the University of Wisconsin-Madison in iPhone processors. The U.S. Federal Court Circuit Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. ruled that no reasonable juror could have determined that Apple indeed infringed on that patent.
U.S. District Court in Fresno, California denied a joint federal and state task force request to hold Facebook in contempt of court for not providing wiretap access to Facebook Messenger calls. This was in relation to a probe of an international criminal gang.
A U.S. International Trade Commission judge declined Qualcomm's request to block the import of iPhones with Intel chips that are subject to a patent dispute. The judge found that Apple's iPhones violated one of Qualcomm's patents on power management, but that denying import was not in the public interest.
All right, folks, that's a quick look at stuff. If you want all the tech headlines each day in about 5 minutes, be sure to subscribe to DailyTechHeadlines.com.
All right, let's start with a little discussion about Intel. Patrick Norton, I know you have some thoughts on this. I'll go ahead and set it up for you. Intel's interim CEO, Bob Swan, announced Friday it will prioritize production of Xeon and Core processors and has enough supplies to meet its full-year revenue targets. The company has been catering more to data centers, but expects growth in the PC market this year for the first time since 2011. Okay. Now, Intel also said that yields are improving for 10 nanometer chips, and it still expects volume production in 2019. So this sounds like good news. What are your thoughts?
Oh, boy. So I'm going to give a shout out to Ryan to jump in at any time. What's interesting about this is DigiTimes, which we affectionately think of as the great rumor mill of all things.
The 50-50 rumor mill, right?
Yeah, the 50-50 yes. rumor mill, right? But one of the things that showed up there and has been repeated in other places is that I want to say like the CEO of Compal Electronics and a couple others are basically saying like, yeah, we can't get enough processors to build notebooks. Q4 is the holiday shopping season. It's going to be a hot mess. And there's also a lot of suggestion that there's not enough Xeon processors to go around to go into servers. And, you know, this is compounding. Ryan and I have a game which goes like, gah, we're starting to feel guilty because there's just not a lot of nice things to say about Intel right now. Now, Intel is making amazing amounts of money. They have a ton of profitable businesses. But as enthusiasts, Intel kind of like wandered away from us as a market, you know, high-end gamers, people doing video editing, and they just seemed to like, yeah, they'll be fine. They have nowhere else to go. They'll just take what we give them, which was a reasonable assumption if you're, you know, that arrogant. And then something really strange happened. They slipped on a process technology, and they kind of went from 2 years ahead and delivering a new process technology, i.e., you know, making everything smaller and fitting more chips on a die, which gives them also improvements in power consumption and improvements in overall, you know, computing power. You know, then they went from like every 2 years for forever. Then it like, it took them like 3 years to do that sort of last 14 nanometer jump in 2014. And then we're still waiting for the jump to 10 nanometer. And in the meantime, Intel's kind of gone from 2 years ahead of competition to actually being behind. And this gets really interesting because TSMC is now delivering their 7 nanometer processes, which is roughly equivalent to Intel's 10 nanometer process. And where it's really kind of painful is the fact that ARM just kind of keeps showing up everywhere and the volume of ARM processors keep getting larger. And the argument back in the day was that Intel's, well, our superior custom, you know, basically like ARM's like, you can build it anywhere. We'll license it to you. You can customize it. We barely use any power. And, oh my God, we've lost Sarah. I've bored Sarah so thoroughly. She's passed.
No one on audio knew that till you called her out, Patrick. That wasn't nice.
I'm sorry. Well, it was just all of a sudden there was a big empty screen and I was like, oh, medic. Yeah. But Intel was always like, you know what? Our superior manufacturing, we're going to keep, you know, moving forward on processor. We got Moore's Law on our side. And that was going to negate sort of whatever advantages ARM thought it had. And to put this into perspective, right, you know, a few years ago, Intel was selling like 100 million desktop chips a year. Much larger margins, much higher cost. But ARM shipped or actually licensed, I want to say 50 billion chips between 1991 and 2013, then 50 billion chips between 2013 and 2017. And they expect to ship the next 100 billion chips by like, you know, 2022, 2023 or so. So where this gets interesting is when we start looking at laptops, and we see the ARM processors starting to show up in low-end laptops. Apple's basically starting to seed the rumors, since Apple doesn't have leaks. Therefore, everything that is about Apple is either a guess or a leak from an official part of Apple, that Apple's going to start replacing Intel CPUs in their laptops with their own A-series. You know, I don't know, the A14, the A15, that Apple's actually going to stop using Intel processors in their laptops, which may not be a huge volume, but is incredibly prestigious. And they're talking about using their own. Apple thinks they can get their own processors fast enough to replace the Intel chips by like 2020. That's the big rumor that showed up on Bloomberg not too long ago. Meanwhile, as AMD's like, hey, out of nowhere, last year, we got a badass desktop processor, and we're going to give you a lot more cores for a lot less money. AMD is looking to actually have something like 30% of the global desktop market by the end of this year. You know, not only is AMD profitable, AMD is actually taking a huge chunk of the desktop market, which is a place where Intel has traditionally had what I will affectionately call a tremendous, you know, I won't say monopoly, but you know, there just wasn't
dominance.
Anything else.
You could use the dominance. Word dominance.
I like
yeah.
that. Yeah. That won't get me, you know, that won't have a lawyer beating on my door saying, don't say that. You know, and if you take a look at if you go to pcper.com/leaderboard, that's the collection of builds that Ryan and his crew put together over at PCPer. And something you'll notice about this, you know, it doesn't matter if you're looking at the dream system, which is like $3,300, or the low end, like I have no money, $500 system. But you're talking about every single one of those chips, unless one has changed and I missed it, having a, oh, look, there's a Ryzen, AMD Ryzen, AMD Ryzen, AMD Ryzen, AMD Ryzen, AMD Ryzen. Because when you're talking about multi-core processing, which is pretty much everything in computing, and, you know, Ryan, feel free to point out that I'm going to get a bunch of nasty emails, tweets about this. When you look at overall performance, it's better to have a lot of fast cores than a few slightly faster cores, or at least the way kind of I approach it. But
I would say that's really dependent on workload, right? Sure. So it's a really interesting environment that Intel finds itself in now, because it's basically being attacked at every front that it has in this battle in the server workspace against AMD EPYC, and a little bit from the ARM designs there. You look at what Qualcomm's doing with their always connected PCs and kind of going after the battery life, massively connected systems. You look at Ryzen, Threadripper going after workstation. There's a lot of angles of attack on Intel. But as you pointed out at the beginning, Patrick, they had like $16 billion in profit last year. Like they're still pumping out parts. They're still a very high margin company. AMD is profitable for the first time, but you know, Intel's R&D budget exceeds all of the revenue AMD had last year, right? So it's right. And I'm as big a proponent of Ryzen and all this. All the AMD products and the ARM products and the Qualcomm products as anybody, but I think sometimes it's easy to lose sight of just the size and the behemoth that Intel is and what it represents. And they definitely screwed up, right? They definitely kind of fell out of their way, and riding that ship is a long process. It's not something that happens in a couple of quarters.
And it felt to me like Krzenich was at least had an instinct of where to go to do that, and it was going to be a long process. So losing him midstream like this certainly can't help.
He was a polarizing figure, I think. He definitely had Intel in all the right places financially, and he knew he had a good idea of how to maintain margins and revenue. But I think you could look at it in that he failed from the point of view of he came in from the manufacturing side of things, right? Mm-hmm. That's his pedigree. And that is the area that stalled out and is causing the problems that they're seeing now. The problems with 10 nanometer are what's causing the shortages with 14 nanometer, which is causing them to have, you know, their interim CEO put out that letter that they did today saying, hey, really sorry about that, but don't worry, investors, we're still going to make all the money we said we were going to make, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. Yeah. But
it goes back to your point about how big they are.
Yeah. Right. I mean, they in mid-year in July, they said, actually, as it turns out, we think we're going to make $4.5 billion more than we thought we were going to make. And, right. You know, of course, the market loves that. And they're saying, even with these issues we're having, we still think we're going to get to all that and maybe a little bit more. But it doesn't mean that doesn't present opportunity for Qualcomm, ARM, and AMD to take over some of the space, because there is growth in PC and in server infrastructure, edge computing. All those areas are growing, and AMD has solutions to offer.
Well, it's the classic case of being too big, to where they can't move fast enough to take on these, you know, and AMD's not a small company, but it's smaller right. than Intel. So relatively speaking, smaller companies. ARM, of course, incredibly different than Intel because it's a designer, not a manufacturer. And so they can be, ARM is essentially attacking them from a million different directions at once, sure. because you have all of these different companies. So it's hard for Intel to respond, especially when you're doing so well, right? Like it's the classic case of, yeah, but we still hit our bottom line. We're still making a profit. What's to panic about? And right. the thing to panic about is what happens a few years down the road when the lead you built up starts to decline, and ask right. Nokia how that feels.
It's true. And as a result, you see the CEO, Brian Krzanich, is out. You see new leadership coming in, Raja Koduri coming in from AMD, Jim Keller coming in from AMD and Apple and Tesla, right? They're coming in. Their goal is to be more aggressive. Their goal is to shift the mindset of the company and make them product facing, right? Like you've got to keep in mind, Intel spent a tremendous amount of resources marketing drones, right? Which is yeah. at best a tertiary market to them. And you look at, you know, it's easy to see how enthusiasts, people that follow what Patrick and I do, get angry because we saw stagnation in the core processor series while they talked about drones and IoT and all this and other
video.
Stuff that is really
had a whole streaming video department that Krzanich just closed up and sold to Verizon.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny when you look at it, because like there's the, I want to say the client computing group is like 30% of the revenue in 2017. Data, the big data stuff's like 20%. Their Internet of Things group, like you're looking at like $19 billion, $16 billion, and then like $897 million for the Internet of Things group. And on one hand, don't get me wrong, I'll never make $1 billion in a year. I'll certainly never have a company that makes $1 billion in a year. So to make most of $1 billion, you know, in a year is a lot of money, until you start looking at the competition for the Internet of Things, which is the 450-something ARM licensees. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're looking at, you know, Qualcomm and Apple and all of these other companies that are customizing the basic ARM designs and putting them everywhere. Let's see. Okay, I've got one here. I've got one there. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in that closet. I've got two in the other end of the house. And they're certainly not making as much per chip, but it's kind of crazy to look at Intel. Intel was an ARM licensee, and they're like, eh. And then a couple of years later, they're like, oh my God, the cell phone thing is serious. And and they spent a bunch of years like trying to jumpstart mobile, and that certainly took off with at least one manufacturer in China for several minutes. And then they, you know, like, you know, Ryan was calling out, there was like, okay, you know, we're going to do the Internet of Things and drones. And they don't seem to be able to sort of jumpstart anything other mm-hmm. than, you know, Xeon, which is a big deal.
Drenched Wildfire in our chat rooms puts this forward. I want to know what y'all think of it. This is less a big company can't pivot problem and more of a this tech is extremely hard to perfect problem.
It is. That's true. So there's two ways to look at it. The process technology is incredibly difficult, and I honestly don't believe anybody in the industry has better engineers than what Intel has and the history that they have. Did they have a hiccup and a bubble in this pipe? They absolutely did. Obviously, they kind of overpromised and have been under-delivering on what they were able to do with 10 nanometers. But it is incredibly hard to get some of this stuff right. But I think a lot of it still comes down to Intel getting away from its core competency and trying to explore other areas of growth, which is, you know, not to make it a political debate. It's one of the pitfalls of being a public company, mm-hmm. is that if you're not growing and you're not trying to expand, you look like you're shrinking. And they wanted to avoid that, and now they're kind of recovering here. They've announced they're going to do discrete graphics, they're going to get into AI, they're going to do in deep learning and machine learning. So there's still plenty of places where they can grow. Mm-hmm. In areas that I think are more approximate to their core competency.
Well, and that's the key, right? You can't just keep relying on classical x86 architecture forever. You know, the writing's on the wall for that. It's not going to die, but the growth is limited. So where do you go? Where should Intel go from there? That's the big question.
Yeah. And I think AI machine learning is kind of the first immediate step. Autonomous, you know, people talk about autonomous vehicles, but any kind of autonomous robotics is really where we'll see the next 10 years going. Quantum computing is kind of the next step past silicon design, right? Mm-hmm. And they have a significant group there. IBM's another one. But that's one of those things that when somebody really smart tries to talk to me about it, I kind of glaze over and I'm like, I got to go read another book or two before we can have this conversation.
Hold on. Let my virtual assistant understand this for me and explain it to me later. Yeah. All right. Well, I think, you know, we could sit here kicking dirt on the purported grave or not grave of Intel all day long. But let's talk about some graphics cards. When last we spoke, it was about whether we would ever be able to afford graphics cards again, Ryan. Thankfully, that problem seems to be easing. So let's turn our attention to voluntarily paying a lot of money for a graphics card. And by that, I mean the NVIDIA 2080, the 2080 Ti GPUs. Now that the dust has settled a little on those announcements, Ryan, if you would, help us understand what these cards actually do and what they're good for.
First of all, I want to compliment you on that introductory piece right there. I never really thought about the analog to before you were being forced to pay $1,200 for a video card, and now you're being asked to voluntarily pay $1,200 for a video yeah. card to get, you know, peak levels of performance. It's an interesting shift. So the NVIDIA RTX 2080, 2080 Ti, and eventually the 2070 are particularly interesting for a couple of reasons. One is the price. They definitely kind of went up the stack in terms of cost, but they also introduced different kinds of technology than you're used to seeing in graphics cards, which is why they moved from GTX to RTX. A lot of it's marketing. A lot of it is, you know, trying to shift the narrative some so that they can justify to everyone the price changes. But they added ray tracing acceleration into the silicon, and they added AI compute into the silicon. The AI compute is something that had existed before as part of their Volta architecture, meant for enterprise machine learning AI, which is one of the areas that NVIDIA is a leader in that field. They're bringing that into the consumer GPUs for AI capabilities. The first one is an image quality improvement called, DLSS, deep learning super sampling, which basically renders at a slightly lower resolution and then upscales it, but is using a machine learning, an AI assisted process that they do a whole bunch of pre-compute on their side with the game beforehand, and they send that library over to you through the GFE and the driver stack. It's a really interesting idea, and I think it's one of many areas where AI will eventually permeate into gaming, whether it be for animation or image quality or actual like NPC interactions. And then the ray tracing acceleration is interesting because I think if you followed graphics technology for a while or at any point, like ray tracing has always been known to be that end goal for us. If we could do ray tracing fast enough, you could create photorealistic imagery without hacks, without having to find these workarounds that the current technology of rasterization really depends on.
Because the idea is that you're computing the light source and just saying, the light's over here, show me what it looks like with light reflecting on it.
Yeah. You're essentially simulating the photons moving through space. Right. And if you have an infinite amount of compute power, you could simulate every ray of light casted from every light source and bouncing off every surface. We're clearly not there yet, and it'll be a while. But the RT cores in the new Turing architecture in these parts accelerates the essentially the hierarchical structure of a ray tracing simulation. And so they've were showed demos and examples of things. It sounds simple when you say it out loud, but like reflections of certain things on windows and surfaces in a game. And you think, well, I already have reflections today. What's the big deal? And then you start to realize that some of the tricks that you have to do, if there is a light source or an effect that is off screen, it can't be reflected on something on screen, because the data is kind of removed from the system in a way to kind of make the system run faster. It's one of those tricks of rasterization to make it look good. But with ray tracing, you get some of that back. You have the potential to get some of that back. Shadows can be simulated very well.
I like to think of it as, with rasterization, you have to tell every surface what light's hitting it. Whereas with ray tracing, you just tell the light where to go.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And the hope is, with ray tracing, at some point, you just don't have to, you don't have to worry about any tricks. You don't have to try to, you know, get around anything that might be holding it back. But that's a performance issue over the long term. But they, NVIDIA claims they've made a significant jump with ray tracing performance because of this acceleration logic in the part. Now, as a result of adding AI and RT support, they've made a much larger GPU. It's probably, I think, 60, 70% larger than the previous GPUs of the similar performance class or similar class, you know, 80 series, 70 series. And they've also gone up a lot in price, right? So the RTX 2080 is $799 for the Founders Edition, and the 2080 Ti is $1,199 for the Founders Edition.
Yeah.
And those aren't totally unheard of prices, because the Titan XP before it was $1,199. But if you look at the 1080 Ti, it launched at $699, I believe.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a $500 price increase from 1080 Ti to 2080 Ti.
Although, and I guess what NVIDIA might say, I don't mean to speak for them, is this is halfway between the 1080 and the Titan. This isn't just a successor to the 1080, right?
No,
actually, I was going to say, mostly what they're going to tell you is that RTX technology is going to deliver the holy grail of gaming performance, and you really should buy one now. Buy one
it's
now.
It's worth every penny for all those games that will someday be made for it.
Yes, and that's where it gets slippery. So, sorry, Ryan.
No, and you're right. I think the problem that reviewers and the enthusiast community had with this launch was that when the 10 series launched, the 1080 was noticeably faster than the 980 Ti. It was like 25% faster or so. And with this launch, the 2080 pretty much just matches the performance of the 1080 Ti, maybe a handful, 3, 4, 5% faster. No power consumption improvements, really, maybe a tiny bit there. So there wasn't this jump that people kind of expected, but you did get this price increase, right? The 1080 launched at $499, I believe, and now we're launching this at $699, $799. It's a big jump. And a lot of what Patrick's right, a lot of what NVIDIA's answer to that is, you know, is that this RTX technology is going to be very different than what you've seen before. The problem is, we don't have the games for it. We don't have, you know, Battlefield 5 is going to introduce it. It was delayed a month, and I don't think the RTX stuff is going to be in there on launch day. It's going to be a patch that will come later. So there's a legitimate argument to have about, should you be buying into RTX technology today without the games and the titles to really support it? There will be some. And, NVIDIA released a list of, I think, 18 games that maybe will support either ray tracing or deep learning super sampling or both, which is a strong allotment, but we don't have them today. And like, when reviews came out, we didn't have anything to really test with except these kind of pre-made canned demos that they provided.
I feel like, you know, the way this goes is, the 2080 isn't an improvement in power over the 1080. The 2080 is an improvement in an entirely new capability. And the response, reasonable response, could be, that's great. When I can use it, I'll want that. But for the time being, couldn't you just please give me a successor to the 1080 that's more powerful? And the argument back against that is, but if we don't put the 2080 out there, it won't create the market that will cause the software to be built for it. It's a little of a chicken and egg problem.
It definitely is. If you look at it, if you're from NVIDIA's perspective, you kind of look at it as, they can raise prices because there's not any competition at the high end, right? The AMD Vega cards lacked against the 10 series already. So the 20 series is coming out. AMD doesn't really have anything on its roadmap. So there's an environment in place where the competition level is reduced, and NVIDIA is able to raise these prices, and they don't really have anything pressuring them to go the other direction. And, you know, it's very similar to when the Apple iPhone 10 launched, the prices went up and everybody went, oh my gosh, I can't believe these prices went up. And guess what? It was their best-selling phone for the four quarters it's been out, right? And that's NVIDIA sees that and goes, well, I want to have higher profit margins. And
I want a higher average price per unit. Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so they're like, well, we'll give it a shot. And worst case scenario, they don't sell out. We kind of go through this process of maybe lowering prices or doing rebates or whatever, or AMD releases something that's a surprise to us and then we readjust. And, you know, I don't think they're as worried about losing goodwill of the community as much of the community would like them to be worried about it.
Sorry, I'll
such
stop
an evil laugh. But true. In the end, though, if I'm a consumer sitting there ready to buy a graphics card for my next machine, is it the smart thing to do to just buy a 1080 then?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say no to that, right? If you look at 1080 Ti, 1080 today, you could buy them new for – you could buy 1080 Ti, I think, for like $499, $479. Is that right? Higher?
Hold that thought.
Okay. Maybe I'm thinking of 1080. I think maybe – yeah,
I know partially my thoughts on this are kind of skewed because I'm looking for a sub 250 millimeter card, which is usually more expensive than a full size card.
Yeah,
but $479 sounds really.
I think that's 1080. 1080 Ti is probably closer to $650 at this point. I think what I was looking at is you can get $100 to $150 less. You can get a 1080 Ti, which is going to have near the same performance level as a 2080. That's going to, you know, be more expensive. And if you're willing to take the chance on used hardware, if you go to eBay, you can get a lot of really inexpensive stuff as mining has fallen off and people start to sell out that hardware. Obviously, you're taking a risk on the longevity and how hard these cards have been worked and what the heat and cooling and all that stuff has been like for that product. Right. But I think that's where you might be able to find a 1080 Ti for $499. But then you've got warranty questions and a bunch of other stuff to digest. Yeah.
I mean, I can find one on eBay right now for $410, but if I want it new from Newegg, it's listed at $700.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think as long as the 10 series cards exist new in the channel, which I actually don't think will be very long based on what some of their partners have told me when production actually stopped and what that inventory was like. A lot of people were holding off on their purchases until these 20 series cards were announced and what the reviews look like. And now I think you'll see a lot of people doing what you're suggesting, Tom, is they're just like, I think I'm going to get that 1080 now. I was waiting. And now they'll do that. That'll buy up. And then eventually you kind of won't have that option anymore. And we'll have to see what the market looks like then, if AMD has progressed or pricing is lower on the RTX units or anything, I guess.
How long, I mean, and I know this is an impossible question, but if you had to guess, how long do you think that is before the channel runs out of 10?
Of 10 series?
Yeah.
I would say it would shock me if by the end of the year that wasn't the case, that we'd be out. Yeah.
But then all of those Bitcoin miners will be dumping their old 1080s.
It's true. You're already starting to see it.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask a quick question. So if that's the case, say that the 10 series literally is sold out and they no more, they're done and they're moving on to the 20 series. Does that leave an opening for AMD to kind of position their wares in that space where, hey, you know what? You don't need to mortgage or your home to buy a new video card. You can get something not as powerful, but you know what? You're not selling off your kids to pay for it.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what they should do, right? If you're AMD, if you're the Radeon group, you need to be looking at any kind of messaging you can do around, hey, we're providing you, you're not going to be the top performer, but you say, hey, if you're one of the 10 million people that has a 1440p monitor or below that plays PC games on AAA titles, our graphics card is going to be perfect for you. And if you're AMD, you're also kind of lucky that NVIDIA wasn't more aggressive on pricing. That means AMD doesn't have to reduce their prices to remain competitive in the space. If they want to stay at, you know, $499 or whatever, and kind of totally undercut what the 2080 and the 2070 will be priced at, they're able to do that. And I think you're right. They should be talking about gaming without a car, you know, less than a car payment type of thing.
It's also kind of crazy that there actually is, now that you know, the 1070s, the 1080s, the 1060s, the 1080 Ti's are, you know, at around or near MSRP, and the 2080s and the 2070s are going to be shipping. There's finally actually AMD parts in the pipeline, which for so much of the last year, it was like they launched, they disappeared. There were several around Christmas, they disappeared. Where were the AMD cards this spring? Nobody knows. And, you know, now that they're getting sort of beat up on technology on one side and performance and price on the other side, they're in the channel. So I think AMD is going to be really popular. If the prices aren't really good on the 20 series NVIDIA cards around Black Friday, I think it's going to be a great Black Friday for AMD GPUs if they can keep the channel full.
I think it's easy to forget, literally 6 months ago, 12 months ago, how screwed up the GPU market was, right? On This Week in Computer Hardware with Patrick and I, every week we would talk about, I don't know, how expensive are all the video cards you can't buy today, you know? And it lasted a long time. We had fallout from, you know, all the other people that make power supplies and cases and keyboards and any other component that would normally be bought in kind of tandem with a new PC build. They were like, I can't buy a video card. I can't afford it. Why would I bother upgrading the rest of my system? And now we're back to a sane spot in the market, but NVIDIA kind of edged us in a little bit with the pricing.
Well, this actually dovetails very nicely into our first advisor discussion of two today, and that is, if you are going to build a PC based on price fluctuations and what's available and who should do this, that is going to be our next topic for the next few minutes. So, Patrick, if I were to say I'd like to build my own PC, would you recommend it to me? And why, based on what I might want to do with it?
Yes, because then I could have you on Tech Thing and we could do a build video on content for the show.
Sounds like a segment pitch suddenly. That's great.
It's going to be great. Get your credit card. We're going shopping.
Well, the reason that I think this is interesting is, you know, I'm sort of the lazy folks who say, nah, I just want, you know, all of, you know, I just want to buy my computer and maybe I'll pay a premium for it. However, it does sound like cobbling together your own PC over the last couple of years has actually been a bit problematic based on lots of factors. So where are we now?
Well, GPUs are affordable again. There's some tremendous, there's some amazing processors from AMD. The stuff from Intel is good. I've just built all the stuff I've built in the last year has been AMD because I'm getting more cores, and then I spend a lot of time with video, so I just want more cores to render faster. I think part of it's like if you go to PC Parts Picker, or if you go to PCPer.com, or if you go to Newegg.com, and you get excited looking at all the listings, you should build a PC. You know, if you're looking at case designs and thinking like that's just exquisite. If you want to build a mini ITX PC, I think you should build a PC. If you are thinking like, you know, if you're not a gamer, if you don't care about LEDs on your motherboard, if you just want to cut a check and have a computer, you know, go to Dell, go to Puget Systems, go to any of a number of either major or boutique builders and buy a PC, because they all do good work. You know, you can put your credit card number in a box from Dell or Lenovo or Puget or whoever is going to show up a few days later, and they'll support it, and they deal with the warranty issues and they burn it in and they set everything up. I mean, I'll be honest with you, if you're not excited, I mean, I should say there's kind of two things. One, if you're not excited by looking at computer parts, don't build a PC. Or two, if you can't look at a pile of computer parts and be like, I want this and this and this and this. You know, when I built my 1800X, no one would have been able to provide me a pre-built system with an 1800X inside of it. So it was the only way I could get that. If you're worried about longevity and you want to pick components that are going to last longer, you know, there's another running joke along with it. So let's see how much the expensive GPUs you can't buy are this week. You know, another thing has been like most power supplies from reputable manufacturers have like a 10-year warranty now.
Yeah.
You know, and you're starting to look at situations where, you know.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero.
If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move. By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. This podcast is supported by Tools and Weapons, the podcast hosted by Microsoft Vice Chair and President Brad Smith. Right now on a special edition of Tools and Weapons, Brad Smith is sharing a vision for what Microsoft calls the new AI economy. It's an idea rooted in technological revolutions of the past, like the printing press, which created a vibrant marketplace of related innovations, ultimately leading to an explosion of books and readers. But he doesn't just give a history lesson. In the episode, Brad lays out the tangible ways that Microsoft is providing infrastructure and other support to those leading the charge of the new AI economy. And he explains the importance of using that infrastructure to ensure equitable access to AI to people all over the world. To stay current on insights from voices at the center of the conversation on AI, follow or subscribe to Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you like to listen.
Like I've got some power supplies that are on my second or third PC. If you've got a PC that, you know, you've been sitting on, like, maybe it's 3 years old and I would have upgraded it last year, but I couldn't buy a GPU. You know, if you don't care about the case, buy a new motherboard, a new processor and a new GPU, you know, and replace the guts. That would be a time to build a PC. You know, it's, you know, Ryzen's giving you amazing amounts of computing power for less money. GPUs are affordable again. Really, for me, though, if you want to build a computer, build a computer. If you have a very specific list of parts you want to build or for a specific situation, you know, build a computer. You know, for a lot of people, it's okay to, you know, be like, eh, I'm over it. I'm done. Just send me a box and let me plug it in and go on my merry way. And that's okay too.
Brian, what are your thoughts on that? You know, if I am looking to save money, but I don't necessarily know what exact parts I want, but they will be advantageous to me if I, you know, figure it out, you know, what are my options?
So I think Patrick is correct in that PC building and used to be, and Tom could back me up on this one probably, it used to be when you would build a PC, it was to save money.
Right.
And now it's not really how it works anymore, right? If you just want a computer, a Dell or an HP from a big box store, you go to Costco or something like that, you're going to get a lot of value there. And I find that even with notebooks. A lot of times yeah. I'll be browsing through Costco and I'll see this Dell XPS 13 and I'm like, oh, wow, that's several hundred dollars less than they were selling on their own website. And that's where I would buy my own machines. Building a PC to save money can be done, but that's more art than science at this point. That is kind of following the rebates, checking out, you know, PCpartpicker.com or Camel or whatever, kind of seeing where the dips are. It's like checking the stock market almost to some degree.
So if you get excited by a pile of parts and you like couponing, then you might be able to.
Yes. And I do think
more selling people, this well, Tom.
More people should build PCs, if only because you're learning while you're doing it. You're understanding the technology. Are there more headaches? Yes, because now you're responsible for support and troubleshooting and that type of stuff. But you're learning as you're going. It's one of the things, you know, when my nephew wanted a PC to do PC gaming, He asked me for a computer, and I said, no, we're going to build one, and kind of walked him through it and taught him how to do that. Now, whether or not he retains that and does it in the future, I don't know. That's on him. But I think from a pricing standpoint, you're always going to get cheaper if you do OEM, unless you're like, I need three GPUs and 128 gigs right. of RAM and 32 cores, right? Then you're getting into super high-end boutique builders, and Patrick's right, building your own will save you money there. But from a price standpoint today, I could say that there's no reason to not build a computer from a cost standpoint.
Wait, say that again.
Let me rephrase that. It used to be, you know, 3 months ago, 6 months ago, I wouldn't tell you to build a computer because the price of memory was so high. The price of graphics cards was so high. Everything has settled back down. Memory is still expensive, but it's not going to change, as it turns out.
So price is basically not a factor. You're not going to save money necessarily, although maybe if you play it right, you could. You're not going to spend more money, which used to be the case a few months ago.
Yeah. I think that's right.
Okay. You mentioned memory. Memory prices are high. Is that the only one to watch out for as far as cost being way up there these days?
I mean, I think so. I think that's the only thing that is outside the bounds of where we feel like it should be, right? But as I watch companies like Micron and Samsung and SK Hynix and all their production capabilities, there's nothing that's going to come online anytime soon where we're going to see a sudden 20% drop in prices like we did with GPUs. Mining died, prices went down, done. With memory, I don't think we're going to see that. If it does come back down, it's going to be a very gradual thing.
And Samsung said they're going to slow down their production.
Weird.
So,
Samsung announced that they were bringing on the equivalent of 20% of the world's current memory fabrication capability this year. So everybody's like, "Woo!" And I think, you know, not that large organizations talk in the background, but I think, you know, maybe, you know, Hynix and Intel and Micron all looked at Samsung like
sent a raised eyebrow Samsung's way.
Really? You think that's smooth? But I mean, it's, you know, the memory has been on this insane ride for the last 18 months, and I don't see any memory manufacturer having any interest in going back to, $60 for 16 gigabytes of Corsair, you know, Vengeance DDR4 RAM in 2016, and it peaked, like, I want to say in February 15 at like $220 for 16 gigabytes. Now it's at $150. I mean, I love Corsair and Micron and everybody else, but I don't see any of them being like, yeah, we should definitely drive things back to the point where you can get two sticks of RAM with an In-N-Out burger. You know,
that's a double.
Yeah, I mean, we got 16 gigabytes went from like $120 in the tail end of 2015 down to like $65-70 in the middle of 2016, and it didn't get back up above $120 until 2017. So we had this long, long spell where memory was really cheap, and then it just went berserk in 2017, along with everything else that went into a PC. You know,
okay, so for somebody who would be interested in building a PC that was, you know, the best PC I could have for editing a lot of video, which I do these days, right? But I don't necessarily, I don't necessarily know exactly what purse I need. And sounds like I'm not necessarily going to save a lot of money doing this. It's more of a, you know, a hobbyist idea, but I could get the best PC for my money. Mm-hmm. Where do I go? Where do I go to find out more about how do I put these parts together if I don't really know this ahead of time?
Where, Ryan? Where could they go?
If only there were a place. I mean, obviously, self-centering, I would say PCPert.com. And the leaderboard there, if you look at that Dream System, it is kind of aimed at the, you know, I think it's a 16-core, 32-thread part. That's going to be a good video editing solution. Price-wise, it's going to be reasonable, and probably the prices are a little bit lower than what you even see there. In terms of pricing, PC Part Picker is the best spot to go. They have tremendous tools that let you pick and part together systems. They track prices over time. They have recommendations from other users. It's something where you can build a system and then save that system, and you can kind of watch the price of it over time. If you don't want to buy today, it's a good kind of note-keeping system as well. There are a lot of places like that. You know, depending on how brave you are, you can dive into some of the DIY parts of the Reddit community and and ask questions about what you should build. But yeah,
ask questions, duck, get a good answer. Yeah.
But I think there's still plenty of outlets for that.
I want to give a shout out also. I mentioned them before, Puget Systems, which is a boutique manufacturer far, far north of where I'm sitting right now. But they've spent a lot of time benchmarking, especially for people who are content creators. If you're looking at Premiere or Photoshop, you know, where they've looked at CPU performance, GPU performance, like what the difference is in, you know, like I'm looking at a benchmark where they look at GTX 1060, 1070, 1080, 1080 Ti, Titan XP, Titan V, and looking at like live frame, live playback and exporting, and what spending, you know, what doubling or tripling the cost of your GPU does to the performance of particular things inside of Premiere Pro, for example. And they've done similar stuff for, you know, After Effects, Photoshop, you know, and I gotta give them a shout out for that, because there's a lot of theory and there's a lot of stuff you can find in forums, but this is one of the only places where somebody's really sat down and looked at, you know, individual component performance. And, you know, they may not be the definitive benchmarks, but there are a lot more you're going to find at most places. And you can look at like, oh, if I do this with, you know, if I put this much CPU into it, I get these results. Or, oh, I may want to concentrate more on GPU. There's a lot of mythology around content creation systems. And, you know, on one level, you know, the simplest one is just buy everything. Because, you know, if you're doing constant production, like, yeah, actually, you'll save a bunch of time if you have 64 gigabytes of RAM and a massive processor and, you know, several terabytes of SSD storage.
Sure.
But, you know, that's also one of those things. You also have to cut that check for all of that stuff, which gets emotionally traumatic when you look at that credit card bill and go like, yeah, I could have bought a used car.
Well, I like this idea that you mentioned about building a PC with your kid or even your nephew or niece, you know, to kind of say, okay, you want a great video game machine, you're going to have to build it yourself. But I bet a lot of parents are put off by that because they've never done it themselves before. Is there a good resource for someone like that who just wants to start putting it together and they don't know what parts plug into what other parts?
That's, you know, that is almost like a lost art, is the explaining at a basic level. Actually, when I did that PC building set up with my nephew, it was probably 3 years ago, maybe more than that now. We recorded it, right? And I walked him through the process, kind of explained things as we went. So that video is out there. I'm trying to remember even where it would be on our youtube.com/PCPer channel, building a PC. I think it was a three part series. But there, you know, again, if you're brave enough, dive into the YouTube world and talk about how to build a PC. But you do want to, you know, get advice from somebody, find somebody either at your work or a friend of a friend that has done it before that can maybe guide you, hold your hand along the way. Because even though I think it's way more simple than it was a decade ago, there's still areas where, you know, you're even if you don't make the wrong decision, you're going to have this indecisiveness that can wear you out during the process, just mentally fatigue you, and kind of getting some of those questions answered and assuring you and along the way would be very helpful.
Well, folks, if you've got ideas about this as well, send us your resources, feedback@dailytechnewsshow.com, because we know a lot of you guys out there have done this, and maybe you've recently learned how to do it yourself. So share the love and share the wisdom with everybody else. All right. So if you are an advisor on the show out at patreon.com/DTNS, you get to suggest topics for the roundtable every month. Usually we would get a bunch of suggestions and we put them up for a vote. This month we got two great suggestions. So we're doing two advisor topics. And the second one is, are $1,000 and more cell phones really worth it for 1 to 2 years of use?
Now, I sure hope so.
Sarah says, having just bought an iPhone XS Max. But here's the thing. I want to before I get opinions from the panel here, I want to point out a few stories that just came out in the last couple of days. Well, a couple of stories and one fact. eBay is now offering wireless plans from Red Pocket Mobile. It's an MVNO as an add-on option when you buy a used phone on eBay. So you can certainly get a great phone for cheaper if you do that, and even sign up for a plan right there as you're buying it. AT&T has announced they plan to build small data centers around the U.S. to support cloud computing over 5G. Now, this is a couple of years down the road, obviously, but the idea is that cheaper phones without as much processing power or memory could be used to rely on the fast 5G connection to do a lot of the processing that, say, an iPhone or a Samsung Galaxy do locally. Finally, worldwide KOS, K-A-I, I like to call it chaos, is a mod of Firefox OS that is now really popular. It uses web apps to power inexpensive phones. So you're talking $10, $20 phones. Jio, Nokia, the banana phone, uses KOS. And it is now the number two operating system to Android in India. 40 million phones worldwide run on it. So now more than ever before, these mid-range phones and sometimes feature phones that run chaos can do a lot of the things that a smartphone can. Is it still worth it? Is there still some reason to say, well, if you have the means, you really should get that top-end phone?
For just 2 years?
Well, and that's the other side of his question, right? I think phones are lasting longer than 2 years these right. days as well. I think, you know, that's the other thing is, do you need to replace it every 2 years anymore?
Well, you know, it's I did just get a new iPhone and, you know, very happy with it. However, I did the last iPhone I had was the 7 Plus. So it has been a 2 year cycle. I skipped the whole 10 last year. And, you know, my previous iPhone, it had a shattered screen. It had all sorts of problems, but it just started to slow down. You know, it was like a senior citizen of phones. The, you know, the screen wasn't very bright anymore. Things didn't really work the way that they were supposed to work anymore. And that was, I limped along barely 2 years. So, okay, sure. If you have the means, the financial means and the interest to get a new phone, whether it's, you know, whatever it is, every year, great. Most people do not. So yeah, how long do you limp along before you have to get a new phone? When it comes to laptops, I mean, I can use the same laptop up to about 10 years, you know? You know, like, pressed, I will do it. When it comes to smartphones, it's a little bit different. I do find that they degrade a lot more easily. Now, it doesn't mean that you need to buy the most expensive phone, but which was, you know, a little bit of a splurge on my part, but I don't know. I you know, I'll open this up to the rest of the group. Do we think that smartphones are kind of along the same lines as PCs?
Really quick, from my personal story, I have a 3-year-old, a little over three and a half year old phone. It's right. A Galaxy S6. The only reason I moved that from the Nexus, was it the second, third Nexus, was that I wanted real-time encryption on the phone, and the Nexus couldn't do that. And that's why I got the phone. But other than that, the phone's fine. It does everything. Does the mapping, does all my social media, does all the pictures and stuff. I don't see a reason to upgrade unless this breaks or, you know, somehow there's an application that I really want to use and it doesn't run very well on it.
I don't know. There's so many variables on this one. The only reason I upgraded my phone, the closest thing I could come to an excuse for upgrading my phone would be that the Compass module no longer worked. And it drives me insane because I use a lot of astronomy apps and navigation apps. Mm. And no, you know, and that was a known issue with the iPhone 6, 6, 6S. But, you know, I picked that up in 2015. I was still using it 3 years later. You know, we needed to get a cell phone for my son to use. So it's like, okay, he can take my 6 and I'll get, I picked up a phone, this Moto G6 I'm running right now, cost a quarter of the price for what I paid for the 128 GB iPhone 6 or 6S. It all kind of bleeds. I'm pretty sure it's a 6. You know, and I probably, I probably have destroyed more screens than the rest of the people on the show today combined. I feel comfortable making that statement. Oh, is it a toss-up, you and me? It took me a while.
After the show.
Well, I mean, I got the iPhone 6. And I want to say I bent the case and broke the screen in the first 6 days of ownership. Bought the extended warranty. All right, you win. Finally found a combination, because I used to use these LifeProof cases where you could pretty much fling the phone into the Grand Canyon, hike down, find it, and pick it up and use it again.
Based on a true story.
Yeah, not quite, but close. The LifeProof cases started falling apart, so I finally found a combination of like the I got to give a shout out. There's a couple companies on Amazon that create tempered glass screen protectors. They're amazing. Since I started using those, I haven't actually broke a screen, knock on wood, but it's been, and I found a case to protect it, but it amazes me that I know some people that, like my wife, used her iPhone for like 6 years, and it got to the point where, you know, everything was flawless on it. Everything was perfect on it. Nothing was problematic with it, but we were no longer getting operating system security updates, and the apps were starting to not work with them. Like, come on, we'll get you a new phone. The camera will be really nice. I also know people who upgrade every single year, which I find excessive. But if you got the discretionary income and you enjoy it, by all means.
I think it's interesting, because I believe most people that you would ask this question to, they would say, no, you don't need a $1,000 phone every year or two. However, they sell an awful lot of $1,000 phones every year. Right. Indicating that some people are still doing this. And I look at it from, you know, maybe a slightly skewed perspective, as maybe many of us do that work in this field. It's the device that you use the most by a significant margin. If I look at my wife, for example, she uses her laptop maybe twice a week, but she's on her, you know, she uses her phone a dozen times a day, if not more, right? For calls, messaging, internet, whatever, you know, searching, movies, research, anything she's doing is on that device. So is $1,000 a year for a phone a lot? It is. And when you break it down to, hey, are you willing to pay $100 a month to have the latest digital pocket device with you? You start to go, ooh, $100 a month. That feels like a lot. But in terms of use and kind of, after a laptop, or a PC, but I guess a laptop, right, something you carry with you the whole time. I can't think of anything that gets more use in my day-to-day life than my phone.
I used to upgrade my laptop every 18 months. I would just run into a wall where I either storage or RAM limitations would force me to do that. I stopped doing that around 2013, and now I no longer have on the tip of my tongue how old my laptop was. I have to think about it. I used to always know exactly what month I was in. Phones are not there for me yet. Phones, I can tell you immediately how long I've had a phone for. Although it used to be at a year, I'd be struggling. Well, can I make it another year? And recently that's become 2 years. At 2 years, I start to feel like, gosh, I really would like to have something a little snappier, right? It's a luxury thing, right? It's not a painful, like it doesn't work thing like Roger's talking about. It works fine, but I just get a little like, but it could be a little faster, right? this is the first time where at a year, and I have the iPhone 10 here that I'm talking about, I don't feel any of that. I feel like this is fine. I'm not tempted in the least. We'll see in 2 years if it's still there. But I think the phones are getting the specs in the phones are better match for the advancements in software than they used to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things I read an article, and I wish I could remember who wrote the column, but they were basically like, if you have last year's iPhone, you don't need this phone.
Yeah.
You know, if you have last year's, you know, Pixel 2 or whatever the flagship was, this is better, but it's not like $1,000 or $1,200 better. If you have a 2 or 3 year old phone, you may be looking at this camera going, I want the precious. I will say it's the one thing, like the camera in the G6 is pretty impressive, but the low light performance just gets spanked by all the flagships. But at the moment, like, I think I'd rather spend $300 or $400 on a discrete camera that'll have the equivalent photo performance than pay $1,000 for a phone that'll have that camera performance. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say the other side of it is what you talked about with the tempered glass. I would love to know. Make sure we get that link in the spreadsheet so that it goes in the show notes for people, because I on the case side have been using the X-Doria defense case, and it has changed my life because I no longer get scratches on my glass, not because it's covering the glass, but because it's got enough of a defense. And this thing has been dropped several times. Is tough as nails. So a lot of it now becomes less about I need to upgrade, but did I protect my phone well enough that it survived for a couple of years?
Yeah.
So we'll make sure to get those in there.
Amfilm tempered glass screen protectors. I'm sure there's other ones that are just as good.
But yeah, there's.
I have this OtterBox. OtterBox on my phone. Because I bought my phone off Amazon unlocked. It's like, I need a case for it. It was like 20 something bucks. Great. My daughter uses this like a football when she throws a tantrum. She's just like, no. And she'll throw it. This thing bounces off wood, stucco, cement, and it's and no cracks, still runs. And this is the thing. I think people have been so used to being told like every year something new, you need to upgrade, because it's something that's been pushed by the manufacturers as well as the phone companies,
right? The carriers, I think, were a big driver on that.
Yeah, especially the carriers, right? You know, sign up and you're going to new blah, blah, blah. But, you know, at some point, you know, you can only surf the web so fast. I'm sure you could get a faster phone, but, like, what would I really do with it? I'm not app heavy. I have, like, maybe 25 apps at most on my phone. And those are the same 25 apps I've been using for the past 6 years.
And I think if you're like Roger, I know a lot of you are, and you need a new phone for whatever reason, these mid-range phones that we're talking about are plenty good. You don't need to buy that $1,000 phone, because just being able to run apps, you know, the hardware can handle that way better than it used to.
I know this is obvious, but I always think of these conversations as, what kind of car do you want to drive? You know, what is your comfort level?
It's getting like that, isn't it? Yeah.
Do you want the expensive audio situation? Yeah. Like, do you want a Mercedes? Do you care? Do you care about having a hybrid? There are all sorts of reasons that you would want, you know, the nicest phone possible. Great. Sure. Most of us just don't have that luxury. Some people do, but most people don't.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, what are the apps? Like Roger was saying, like, what are the apps you're actually using? You know, of 25 apps, how many apps is Roger actually opening per day? Five, maybe?
Yeah.
You know, think about that.
Five at most.
Yeah. You know? Think about that. Think about, you know, the comfort level, the battery life, you know, stuff that actually matters more than, you know, a lot of the bells and whistles that I think a lot of us get caught up in that quite honestly don't matter as much.
Yeah. And that's one of the brilliances of KOS is that it made a point of using HTML5 CSS based apps, but still curating an app store. So it was able to get the apps that people most often want to use, the WhatsApps, the Twitters, the Facebooks, because it's easy to develop them if you already have a mobile website. And people, you know, the idea of millions of apps is enticing in the abstract. But like you said, in general, you know, I probably use five or six apps every day. Yeah.
Me too. Me too.
I've got Google Maps, Google Play Music, Slack, Feedly, the BBC News app, Pocket Camp, Instagram, Twitter, the Weather Channel, Patreon, TV Time, Gmail, Safari, and our groceries.
The Weather Channel.
Yeah. And Sarah, you're a little crackly. I don't know if you saw my message, but you're
oh, audience. I didn't.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Got it.
You know what's weird is I didn't think you could do this very well, but I run OpenVPN for Android on my phone, and it works pretty snappy. Like I thought it would have been noticeably slower. It's not. It's fantastic. I love this thing. I'm never going to get rid of my phone.
The Galaxy S6 forever!
Forever. Until they no longer update it and there's a new OS that will run.
Before we wrap up this topic, just round the horn. I've had my phone for just about a year now. Patrick, how long have you had yours?
This Moto G6, several weeks.
That's right. You just got the G6. Yeah, Ryan, what about you?
Yeah, I'm guilty of that too. 7 days.
Yeah. All right. So we are not a representative panel for the longevity. Yeah.
Well, it was 3 years before that, right?
Okay. That's probably the more pertinent question.
My son now has that phone, so it's closing in on 4 years.
How about Ryan before yours?
I'm the yearly guy.
Once a year. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Sarah was a couple of years, so, and she just got a new phone as well. All right. Well, thank you, folks, for hanging out with us. I hope you enjoyed. I hope you learned something. And I hope you're going to like Len Peralta's illustration. Len, what did you write for us today?
Well, we talked about a lot of really great things today. But I went all the way back to the beginning of the show where we talked about the View As hack. In Facebook, and that's what I drew. I drew this monster viewing one of the, I guess, the representative of the 50 million people who were hacked by this this little thing, being scrutinized by a huge eye monster.
I mean, I think this is just Facebook. It does it works for the story today, but yeah, it could work for a lot of stories.
You're absolutely right. It is sort of Facebook. And I know it wasn't, you know, it's not as bad as it probably could have been, but, you know, I just like kind of giving Facebook a hard time. And what's also kind of neat about this image is that because it is a round table image, it's 11 by 17. And this is available right now in my online store. And also, if you're a Patreon backer, you will get this, I believe, in a month and a half just by backing me at the DTNS lover level at patreon.com/Len.
Thank you, Len. That's awesome.
No problem. Thank you.
Well, and thanks to everybody who makes our roundtable so fun every month. We really enjoy these, particularly Patrick Norton and Ryan Trout today. Patrick, let's start with you. Let folks know where they can keep up with all of your other work.
Oh, my goodness. Techthing.com, T-E-K-T-H-I-N-G.com, the weekly show I host with Shannon Morris. And if you're into home theater and speakers and headphones and all that kind of stuff, please check out AVEXCEL.com, AVEXCEL. That's the podcast I host with Mr. Robert Heron, where we talk about screens and projectors and speakers and AVRs and headphones and music and source material and dogs and occasionally food recipes. We wander sometimes.
Sounds like a perfect show. Ryan Trout, thank you to you as well. So nice to see you and talk to you again. Let folks know where they can keep up with all of your excellent work as well.
I'd say first and foremost, Twitter at Ryan Trout is there for that. PCPer.com is where you can find all the hardware news, the leaderboard, all the component products that we test are all done there. And then, of course, Patrick and I do This Week in Computer Hardware as well, which is at twit.tv/Twitch, which we talk about, guess what, computer hardware.
Go check both of those out, folks. And thank you for supporting us directly. There's lots of different ways to do it. If you just listen to the free public feed, you're already doing it. But if you would like to support us directly, cut out the middleman, head to dailytechnewsshow.com/support. And if you like this kind of roundtable format, join on in the fun or up your pledge and get some of our cool perks like Good Day Internet, exclusive columns, and more at patreon.com/DTNS. If we can make it to our next milestone, we would like to do more of these roundtables a month. So join in on the fun, patreon.com/DTNS.
If you have feedback for us, questions, comments, anything, please let us know. Feedback at dailytechnewsshow.com is the way to do that. We're also live Monday through Friday at 4:30 p.m. Eastern, 20:30 UTC. If you can join us live, great. We would love to have you. Find out more at dailytechnewsshow.com/live.
Back on Monday with Andrew Zarian as our guest. Talk to you then.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network. Get more at frogpants.com.
You have enjoyed this program.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Stripe Tap to Pay on iPhone came along and changed everything. With Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. No more juggling different methods. Just a simple tap on my iPhone and transactions are complete. What's truly remarkable is how Stripe caters to all my customers' preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Stripe ensures a smooth checkout experience every time. Setting up Stripe was a breeze, taking just minutes to get up and running. From local markets to global retailers, Stripe helped me expand my reach and grow my business with ease. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit. If you own or operate a business, whether it's a local operation or a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America could be your smartest move.
By teaming with Bank of America, you'll enjoy exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter.
Position your business to capitalize on opportunity in a moment's notice.
Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.